Bernie makes it an even dozen. Bill Weld makes it an odd one. And Chicago ponders another round of the Daily News, all on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Presidents have used emergency powers before, but are there differences this time with Donald Trump's end run around Congress?
Here we have a direct challenge to the separation of powers. Congress has said no to spending, and the president says, I'm going to get access to this money anyways. That's simply a straightforward effort to go around the system that exists under the Constitution.
Plus, can Bernie Sanders retain the anti-establishment mantle he held in 2016?
There are going to be 20 people in this race, and there are probably going to be 5, 6, or 7 people who share Bernie's progressive agenda. So how does he distinguish himself from those other people?
And Chicago readies itself for the next chapter after 8 years of Rahm Emanuel.
Because we have 14 candidates running for mayor, everything is fractured, which is what's going to make this runoff so interesting.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And Ike to you, and Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 265 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. For all the nonstop coverage of the Democratic race for president in 2020, there may be a fight on the Republican side as well. Maybe. Last week in New Hampshire, Bill Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, who was the Libertarian Party's candidate for vice president in 2016, and who late in the campaign urged voters to choose Hillary Clinton, announced he would form an exploratory committee to take on President Trump next year.
The truth is that we've wasted an enormous amount of time by humoring this president, indulging him in his narcissism and his compulsive, irrational behaviors. Because of the many concerns I've talked about today, I have established an exploratory committee to pursue the possibility of my running for the presidency of the United States as a Republican in the 2020 election. I encourage those of you who are watching the current administration nervously but saying nothing to stand up and speak out when lines are crossed in dangerous ways. We cannot sit passively as our precious democracy slips quietly into darkness.
Weld is 73, 1 year older than Trump. He supports abortion rights and gay rights, two positions where he may not find himself in the majority of the GOP. In addition to voting for Clinton in 2016, he endorsed Barack Obama over John McCain in 2008. It's hard to make the case that he's a threat to Trump's renomination. And he may not be the only Republican planning to run. John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, is thought to be plotting out a challenge as well. But for now, at least, the odds of Trump being toppled in the primaries seem very low. The Republican Party has become Trump's party. Of course, there's no shortage of Democrats who are running. We'll focus on the latest one to announce, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, later in the program. But that leads to this week's trivia question. Sanders is the sixth senator to run, along with Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, and Amy Klobuchar. In U.S. history, only three sitting senators, Warren Harding, John Kennedy, and Barack Obama, were elected president. The question, in the elections of the past century, what senator came the closest to reaching the White House but never did? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
So close.
Close, but no cigar. Just as everyone, including Donald Trump, expected, the lawsuits against the president's declaration of a national emergency and his decision to doing an end run around Congress to get money to build his border wall have commenced. A coalition of 16 states, mostly all of them with Democratic governors, filed a suit Monday in federal court claiming that Trump didn't have the power to divert funds for the wall because Congress decides where the money is spent. The suit was filed in the federal district court in San Francisco, and it's led by California State Attorney General Javier Becerra, who said that Trump undercut his own claim that there was an emergency by what he said last week at the White House.
The primary fight was on the wall. Everything else, we have so much, as I said, I don't know what to do with it. We have so much money. But on the wall, they skimped. So I did. I was successful in that sense, but I want to do it faster. I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster. And I don't have to do it for the election. I've already done a lot of wall for the election, 2020. And the only reason we're up here talking about this is because of the election. And I think that I just want to get it done faster. That's all.
Which, of course, undercuts his argument for an emergency. The plaintiffs argue that Trump's action ignored the constitutional role Congress plays in money matters. Even some Republicans have indicated disapproval of the action. That list apparently doesn't include Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who had reportedly for weeks been urging Trump not to take such action. But when the president went ahead with it, McConnell took to the Senate floor to announce he was on board.
I've just had an opportunity to speak with President Trump, and he, I would say to all my colleagues, has indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time. And I've indicated to him that I'm going to support the national emergency declaration.
That doesn't necessarily mean the courts will go along. And for that discussion, we turn to Chris Adelson, an assistant professor of government at American University and the author of Emergency Presidential Power, From the Drafting of the Constitution to the War on Terror. Professor Adelson, it's great having you on the program.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
As many people have noted, including Trump himself, presidents have in the past used their powers to declare national emergencies. I think something close to 60 times since Congress enacted the National Emergency Act of 1976. But this is the only one I could think of where a president went to Congress for money, was rebuffed, and then announced he was going to spend it anyway.
That's right. Of course, presidents have done this before in a general sense that they've declared emergencies, but they haven't done it in this specific way. They didn't do it when Congress told them, no, you can't spend money. So it's a direct defiance of Congress and really the constitutional system of separation of powers. And of course, that's also a bogus emergency. Everyone knows that. The president, by his own words, as you pointed out in the intro, knows that too. So it's really a very dangerous moment for the constitutional system.
Well, there's also the question of what constitutes an emergency. I mean, Trump's argument that these people are invading the border apparently doesn't line up with his own administration's facts.
That's true. The president actually on that point should be on pretty strong ground. And if this case goes to the courts, it's not clear that he loses, which is why I think, by the way, that Congress really needs to act. But the president dug himself a pretty big hole. The statute that you mentioned, the National Emergencies Act of 1976, allows presidents to declare national emergencies, and it does not define those emergencies. So the president, pursuant to the statute, could say, what I say is an emergency, and he's got a pretty good argument for that. The problem is he gave away the game. He said, I didn't have to do this. I didn't need to do this. I just wanted to go fast. That's not an emergency by his admission. So I think that creates a really big hole in his legal argument. Hopefully it doesn't come to that. I'm really hoping. I know much of the commentary and coverage assumes that Congress will not act, and that's probably correct, unfortunately. But let's give it a chance. Congress has the tools available to act, and I hope that they do.
Well, before we get to Congress, what Congress may do, and I really want to talk about that too. But even when Trump said that all these people who are invading the border, what the administration has been coming up with, the facts by Homeland Security, is not apparently what the president has been relying on. And the president was called out on that by a reporter last week, but he didn't want to hear of it.
crime reporting statistics that we see show that drugs are coming across at the ports of entry, that illegal immigration is down, and the violence is down. Okay. So what do you base your facts on?
Come on, let's go.
Secondly, you get one.
Well, the
ready?
Second
Just
question sit down.
Is...
Wait, sit down. Sit down.
Could you please
sit
answer
Sit down.
It.
You get one question. I get my numbers from a lot of sources, like Homeland Security, primarily. And the numbers that I have from Homeland Security are a disaster. And you know what else is a disaster? The numbers that come out of Homeland Security, Kirsten, for the cost that we spend and the money that we lose because of illegal immigration. Billions and billions of dollars a month. Billions and billions of dollars. And it's unnecessary.
So your own government stats are wrong, are you saying?
No. I use many stats.
Could you share those stats with us?
Let me tell you. You have stats that are far worse than the ones that I use. But I use many stats.
Chris, I don't even know how to respond to this.
It's incoherent. It's so painful to hear this. It's really difficult. But, you know, one person, Jay Rosen, who's a journalist, I think he's a professor at NYU School of Journalism.
Yes, he was on our program a few weeks ago.
Oh, great. He's really one of the best voices on this. He has made the really important point that you're suggesting here is that he says there's not really a White House. There's the president, and then there's other people who say different things, but they don't connect. They don't speak for him. And that creates a problem in so many ways. It creates problems when you're negotiating with Congress. It creates problems when you're negotiating with foreign countries. It creates problems when the president simply makes up information and won't reveal it. It's really bizarre and does not make any sense. It's a problem, and it's a problem that Congress needs to respond to.
Well, apparently Congress is prepared to respond. Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Wednesday that the House is going to vote to block the move, but... Well, two things. One, it's still uncertain what action the Senate will take, even though some Republicans, including Susan Collins of Maine, have said that she would vote against the president on this. But whatever the Senate does, it's still unlikely that Congress would have the votes to override what would be a likely veto.
That's right. And I actually think this is one example of what I describe as constitutional failure. Our system is not working with this current crisis. It's not just this president. There's been other recent problems too, but it's highlighted by this president. And we're simply, our Constitution is not up to the challenge of a president who sets aside the rule of law because members of Congress or the president's own party are not doing their jobs. Again, it's not unique to this president, but he really highlights the problem. I'm worried for two reasons, though. One, I'm worried because an emphasis on the courts kind of absolves Congress of its responsibility, and Congress is best positioned to act here. It's very clear under the statute Congress can stop this. It's not clear the courts can. There's an argument to be made, and it's probably a stronger one than the argument supporting the president, but it's not a slam dunk by any means. And then the second problem to that point, because it's not a slam dunk, and given the composition of the current court, which the president is very well aware if he's made that allusion recently in his comments, he expects the court to rule in his favor. And I would not, unfortunately, put anything by the current court. I don't think they can be counted on to set effective limits on this president. So the courts are an option that must be used because Congress can't be counted on to act, but the unfortunate reality is we can't count on the courts either. So we're in a real dangerous moment here.
Well, you know, when you were talking about what the courts are, what the Democrat attorneys general are trying to do with the court system, it's almost a mirror image of what Republican attorneys general did with their lawsuit against President Obama in 2014 regarding, you know, giving undocumented aliens work permits and protecting them from deportation. But that had nothing to do with asking Congress for money being turned down and then going ahead and spending it anyway.
That's right. So President Obama and President George W. Bush before him took actions that pushed the limits of the law. And I've done writing about that. And I think they made mistakes in some areas and went too far. This is different. This is a step beyond for two reasons. One, as you said before, because here we have a direct challenge to the separation of powers. Congress has said no to spending, and the president says, I'm going to get access to this money anyways. That's simply a straightforward effort to go around the system that exists under the Constitution. And the second reason this is different to me than anything that President Bush or President Obama or really any president since Nixon has done is that this president is an authoritarian. What I mean by that is he is somebody who would like to undermine the rule of law, who challenges the idea that there are any legitimate limits on his power, and rejects the very idea of constitutional democracy. By that, I don't mean he's a, you know, a Mussolini or a Stalin. I think he's a would-be Viktor Orban or Recep Tayyip or Erdogan in Turkey, or even Vladimir Putin in Russia. He's somebody who would like to rule without limits on his power. And that doesn't mean he succeeded or necessarily will succeed, but he sure would like to.
I was going to say he's a Donald Trump, right?
He's, of course, he's a Donald Trump. And he has made very clear he does not accept. This goes back to, I remember the Access Hollywood tape got a lot of attention, rightly so, because the president was, at the time the candidate was bragging about sexual assault. One thing that really caught me about that tape is he said, when you're a star, they let you do it. That's what he thought as a celebrity. As president, his power is much greater, and he thinks, when I'm president, I get to do it too, whether it's, you know, cashing in an office, appointing family members who are not qualified to high positions in the administration, or getting access to money when Congress tells him no, or shutting down investigations that are dangerous to him or his family. This is really an attempt to set aside the rule of law on a scale we haven't seen since Nixon.
And, you know, and when I think back, I think back with all the agitation, the Republican agitation against what Obama tried to do in 2014, including Donald Trump himself. It's unconstitutional. It's lawful. It's unlawful. It's illegal. I mean, look, hypocrisy didn't begin with this administration or this Congress. But when you think of what Obama tried to do, it's like, it's quaint almost.
Yes. I agree. And it is hypocritical, and it really is difficult to watch this, to see people who described Obama wrongly as a dictator. Doesn't mean Obama was perfect. I wrote a book explaining why I thought he had exceeded the limits of his power in some circumstances. But what we're seeing now is on a completely different scale. The important division to me right now in the United States politically is not between Republicans and Democrats or conservatives and liberals. It's simply between people who support the rule of law and those who do not.
Chris Adelson is an assistant professor of government at American University and the author of Emergency Presidential Power, From the Drafting of the Constitution to the War on Terror. Chris, I think you need a new chapter in this book. Maybe you have to rewrite the book, but...
That's right.
Chris, thank you so much for being on the show.
I appreciate your talking about these issues.
As we noted earlier, President Trump acknowledged in his press conference last week that he expected this to go through the legal system.
And I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court. Just like the ban, they sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
Well, if that wasn't enough, there's a guy by the name of Nick Lutzko who decided to put that to music on Twitter.
We will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban. They sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
Brilliant. In 2016, he was a phenomenon, improbably coming close to snatching the Democratic nomination for president. In 2020, Bernie Sanders will be trying again. On Tuesday, he set up an announcement by video on his website.
Today in America, we have enormous problems. They are solvable problems.
This country belongs to all of us. We want to make policy that improves the lives of all of our people. That's how we transform America.
But before that, he made it official that morning on Vermont Public Radio in an interview with host Bob Kinzel.
I'm running for president, I think, for two basic reasons, Bob. Number one, I think the current occupant of the White House is an embarrassment to our country. I think he is a pathological liar every day. He is telling one lie or another. And it gives me no pleasure to say that. But I also think he is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, somebody who is gaining cheap political points by trying to pick on minorities, often undocumented immigrants. And I cannot recall, certainly in my lifetime, and I think in modern history, that we have had a president who actually goes out of his way to try to divide the American people up based on where we were born or the color of our skin or our gender or whatever it may be.
And he said he wanted to build on what he accomplished in 2016.
We made a lot of progress in bringing forth ideas which 3 years ago people were saying, oh, Bernie, these ideas are radical and they're extreme. The American people, you know, won't accept them. Well, it turns out that 3 years have come and gone, and many of the ideas that I talked about, you know, that health care is a right, not a privilege, and we've got to move toward a Medicare for all, a single-payer program, very, very popular. The idea that we have got to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, there are now five states in this country that have passed that legislation, and I hope Vermont will follow. And I believe it will pass the U.S. House of Representatives, and we're going to have a heck of a fight in the Senate. But that has gained enormous momentum. The idea that if you work 40 hours a week in the richest country in the world, you should not be living in poverty, that's an idea whose time has come.
But there are a lot of questions. Mostly, with so many other candidates in the race, can he still command the loyalty and votes of progressives? And is being 77 years old a concern? And should it be? That's just some of the questions I'm going to throw out at Bob Kinzel, who interviewed Sanders for Vermont Public Radio and who has known and covered him for a long time. Bob, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, it's great to be here.
Well, first, congratulations on getting that interview with the senator on Tuesday morning. I know Stephen Colbert mocked VPR, but I thought it was classy that Sanders wanted to tell you and Vermonters first.
I think it was very important to him to do that, that the perception of coming to Vermont and talking to Vermonters and saying, yes, I did just get reelected to the United States Senate, but I also want to run for president, that it was very important for him to deliver that message initially to people in the state of Vermont.
How long have you covered him?
I've covered Bernie since 1981 when he became mayor of Burlington, Vermont.
Now, as we saw in 2016, he still seems capable of raising a ton of money and from a ton of supporters. His campaign claimed he raised nearly $6 million from more than 225,000 donors within 24 hours of his announcement. And he has this unique ability of drawing big crowds to his events. So at least in the early stages of this second run, he doesn't seem to have lost his magic.
Not at all. And what a difference it is from 2016 when he announced in Burlington in May of 2015, he was at about 3% in the polls. And then, of course, his campaign grew over that summer and fall. And I think it's fair to say that he starts as a front runner in this race, raising that kind of money. He raised $250 million 4 years ago from more than a million donors. I think the average contribution was around $27. That's what he's doing this time. He can keep coming back to these people month after month and say, I really need your help again. Can you give me another $25? So in terms of money, he's in really good shape.
Yeah, I'm always nervous about us, we folks in the media, talking about front runners. I think we should wait until voters have their say. But you're absolutely right. I mean, those again, those first 24 hours, the amount of money he pulled in, the amount of attention he got nationwide, the number of donors he still has at his call is pretty impressive. But I think you'll agree with me that there are a lot of differences between now and 2016.
Oh, there's no question that there are. I think there are many big differences. You know, one is what you mentioned. There's a very crowded field. It's not just Bernie Sanders running against Hillary Clinton anymore. There are going to be 20 people in this race, and there are probably going to be 5, 6, or 7 people who share Bernie's progressive agenda. So how does he distinguish himself from those other people? That's a big one. His ideas really are now mainstream in the Democratic Party, and they were somewhat radical. Medicare for All was a little bit radical 4 years ago. Now everybody's talking about it.
Free college tuition.
Free college tuition. Got to do something about climate change. You know, the other thing is, in 2016, Bernie didn't get a lot of scrutiny from Hillary Clinton. He got some, but Hillary Clinton really didn't want to alienate Bernie supporters. Donald Trump didn't go after Bernie Sanders because Trump wanted Sanders to do well at Clinton's expense. So I think this time around, we're going to see much more scrutiny of the Sanders progressive agenda from the moderates in this race, and that's something that did not happen before.
I mean, not only was he running against Hillary Clinton in 2016, but he was running against the establishment. And now, if you look at so many other candidates, there are so many anti-establishment candidates.
Well, exactly. And remember now, Bernie Sanders has a leadership position in the Senate Democratic Caucus. So he is the status quo now. He's not the insurgent.
Can you imagine the thought of Bernie Sanders as a status quo? But you know something, when you start a revolution, as he says he started in 2015, 2016, sometimes his supporters say, well, that's very nice, thank you very much, and we'll take it from here. I'm thinking of people like Tulsi Gabbard, you know, the congresswoman from Hawaii, who's a big Bernie supporter in 2016, who's now running on her own. Elizabeth Warren, who shares a lot of his views, is also in the race. So I was thinking, there was a headline in the Washington Post, I guess on Wednesday, and the headline said, "Bernie, your moment has come and gone." The column compared Sanders to Eugene McCarthy. But the point is, in 2016, Bernie was David and Hillary Clinton was the Goliath. And you have a lot of Davids running and maybe a lot of women whose names may be David. I don't think that's possible, but you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. And former UVM political science professor Garrison Nelson, I thought, put it very well. He referred to Bernie Sanders as the Barry Goldwater of the Democratic Party, and this is what he meant, that, you know, Goldwater was able to get the nomination in 1964, and then he was defeated decisively. But Goldwater was able to reshape the direction of the Republican Party, and I think you can probably make a pretty good argument that Ronald Reagan might not have become president without Barry Goldwater. And so is that the role that Sanders is in now? Has he reshaped the priorities of the Democratic Party? And if that's true, are the Democrats ready now to move on to a younger face? I mean, look at all the people who got elected to the U.S. House in November. A lot of women. It's a very diverse group. Is a 77-year-old man the face of the new Democratic Party? I think that's the big question.
It is a big question. And I guess the other question is, how important is it? I mean, I assume you talked to Bernie Sanders about the age, and I'm sure he's well aware of his age and that he'll turn 80 in his first term. How does he deal with that? How can you deal with it? That's the fact of life, right?
Well, it is, but he also says that the Democrats should not pick a candidate based on their gender, the color of their skin.
I have to interrupt you here because I think that fascinated me. I thought that was, I mean, of all the things I listened to in your interview with Bernie, that part of the interview hit me the most. First of all, let me play your question.
Bernie, we saw in the 2018 election that Democrats were able to elect a lot of younger and more diverse candidates to the U.S. House. So what do you say to those people who argue that an older candidate like yourself really isn't the face of the new Democratic Party?
And let me play part of his answer that seemed to upset a lot of people.
We have got to look at candidates, you know, not by the color of their skin, not by their sexual orientation or their gender, and not by their age. I mean, I think we have got to try to move us toward a non-discriminatory society which looks at people based on their abilities, based on what they stand for.
Bob, it almost sounded like he really didn't appreciate how quickly the party is changing.
I think that's true. And he sees now in Washington a very different Democratic Party. Look at all the different candidates who are in this race. Who would have thought that there'd be 15 or 20 people in this race, including a number of women in the U.S. Senate? And so from his point of view, he's got to wonder, is time now passing him by? Did he catch lightning in a bottle 4 years ago and set the stage for somebody else to take over?
And most of the stuff I've read about his candidacy since he announced this week has been positive. But I still, you know, I still remember speaking to many delegates at the 2016 convention, and many Sanders supporters said they still have bad feelings about Hillary Clinton, and many Clinton supporters told me that they felt that he was hurting her candidacy. So is there still some bad blood left over from 2016?
I don't think there's any question, Ken, except that there is. There are people in the Clinton campaign who felt that Bernie could have done a lot more to help Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I think the other big question out there for the Democrats this time around is the number one priority is defeating Donald Trump. That's number one over everything else, over any kind of policy or any kind of philosophical or ideological agenda. Democrats want somebody who can beat Donald Trump. And the question, I think, for the Democrats is that person Bernie Sanders, or are they better off with somebody else?
Well, obviously, I guess we'll start to find that out this June when the debates begin, and we'll see how he fares and how he appeals to the voters. But another thing I notice is that in many of the articles I've read about him in recent days, they focus on allegations of sexual harassment that took place in his 2016 campaign. I know he's addressed that, but again, in this Me Too era with so many women running for office, how serious is that?
I think initially it was quite serious. And some of the things that I'm not sure really came out in those articles, in addition to the discrimination against women in the campaign, in addition to sexism in the campaign, there was also a wing of Bernie supporters, and they were known as the Bernie Bro. And these guys would take to calling up talk shows and discrediting women on the air. We had a couple of cases in Vermont Public Radio where they called up and attacked some of our analysts on the air. They had absolutely no tolerance for women or for anybody who didn't think that Bernie Sanders was going to be the next president of the United States. And I remember talking to Bernie about that, and he said, you know, what can I do? My campaign has taken off. It's just been an explosion. I can't control every person. All I can do is ask people to be respectful of other people.
You know, Bob, you know him well, and I know that you know him well. Are we seeing the same Bernie Sanders as we did in 2016? And with the party and the country having drastically changed since then, would it be enough to be the same Bernie Sanders from 2016?
There's the $64,000 question. I think it is the same Bernie Sanders. I went back 4 years ago, and I have a lot of archive tape of Bernie Sanders from his days as mayor of Burlington, when he served in the U.S. House, and then, of course, when he came to the U.S. Senate. And we put together a collage of tape. And what he's saying today is really no different than what he said 35 years ago. And I think that's what part of his appeal is to a lot of people, that he hasn't all of a sudden decided that Medicare for All is a good idea. He's always thought it was a good idea. He's always talked about income inequality. I mean, I have a little piece of tape when he came down to the legislature to talk to the House Appropriations Committee in 1985, and the big issue in Vermont at that time was whether or not people could have radar detectors on the highway. And he looked at the members of this committee and said, I can't believe you are spending your time on this stupid issue when you should be addressing income inequality in the state of Vermont. So that's been the message since day one.
I'm smiling, picturing that, because that's exactly how I picture Bernie Sanders. Bob Kinzel is a reporter and host at Vermont Public Radio. Bob, your life suddenly got even more hectic than it had been, didn't it?
It certainly did. We got some reaction from, as you mentioned, Stephen Colbert. We talked to the BBC. So for a week, it was pretty crazy.
And it was also the political junkie. Don't forget that.
That's right.
Bob, it's great having you on the program.
My pleasure. Anytime, Ken.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what year was the first time a former astronaut ran for public office? The answer, 1964. John Glenn declared he would challenge Ohio Senator Stephen Young in the Democratic primary. But 5 weeks into his candidacy, Glenn fell in his bathroom that left him with an inner ear injury and loss of balance, which forced him to withdraw from the race in late March, though too late to get his name off the May primary ballot. Glenn went on to run again in 1970 when he lost the Democratic primary in a surprise, and 1974 when he was victorious in the first of his four Senate terms. Anyway, the randomly selected winner is Greg Evangelatos of Reno, Nevada. Greg wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. There are two vacancies in the House of Representatives, and both involve seats from North Carolina. One is the 3rd District, left open following the February 10th death of Republican Walter Jones, Jr. Governor Roy Cooper has yet to announce the date of a special election. And the other is in the 9th District, which has been thrown into controversy over allegations of fraud. Back in the November election, Republican Mark Harris led Democrat Dan McCready by 905 votes. But election officials had refused to certify the results because of concern that absentee ballots may have been doctored to fix the election and help Harris win. After 4 days of hearings of the North Carolina State Board of Elections, which started with Harris insisting he be seated and Democrats insisting on a new election, it was resolved in dramatic fashion on Thursday. Harris finally relented and agreed about a new election.
Through the testimony I've listened to over the past 3 days, I believe a new election should be called. It's become clear to me that the public's confidence in the 9th District seat general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted.
It was a stunning reversal, and the State Board of Elections, with 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans, unanimously agreed a new election will be held. Jeff Tiberi is a political reporter with radio station WUNC and joins us now. Jeff, a very dramatic change of events.
Ken, there are unconfirmed reports that John Grisham was in the room this week, and he is working on his next novel. It will be based off of the scandal in North Carolina. I'm kidding. There were no signs of John Grisham, but this was right out of some sort of novel. I mean, the kind of testimony we had this week, at one point Mark Harris's son took the stand. Of course, Mark Harris, what we thought for a while was the congressman-elect, the presumptive winner by about 900 votes, 905 votes back in November. He has said repeatedly in interviews with the media that he had no reason not to trust the operative who's at the center of this illegal ballot harvesting scheme.
Well, yeah, hold on. Before we get to what happened there, remind us what the controversy was all about. I mean, Leslie McCrae Dallas Jr. Tell me about the alleged activities of what he's said to have done.
Well, this goes back, these antics go back several election cycles. And the short of it is they had an operation where they were collecting absentee ballots. And in doing so, they were allegedly, and based on testimony this week, it appears they were certainly violating several state laws, several election laws, in the way they were picking up ballots and the fact that when there were some of the ballots they collected were not complete. And then folks, as part of this operation, were completing those ballots. There were clearly several felonies that may very well have taken place as part of this scheme. And this was something that was well known in Bladen County, which is a small, relatively poor county in southeast North Carolina, and something that's been going on for, as I mentioned, but you know, we think at least a decade.
From the beginning, Mark Harris, the alleged, you know, the Republican candidate, said he knew nothing about this. He knew nothing about Dallas's past. And yet there was a big drama on Wednesday when his son, John Harris, testified. Let me play a little bit of that tape.
I expressed my concerns based on everything that I did know up to that point, namely my belief that McCray had engaged in collecting ballots in 2016. I told him that collecting ballots was a felony, and I would send him the statute that showed that collecting ballots was a felony.
So the him that John Harris is talking about is his dad. He said he told his dad in 2017 all about Dallas, and Harris came into this hearing saying he knew nothing about this.
That is absolutely correct. And one of the things that we learned as the week grew longer was that Harris didn't realize that certain conversations and certain correspondence were going to be exposed in this hearing. So, yes, that was a major moment, a dramatic moment in his testimony when John Harris, who we should note is an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of North Carolina, not only testified to that, but there were also emails that were entered into the docket as evidence, further demonstrating that he had warned his dad about the shady operations of Leslie McCray Dallas.
Part of the drama I thought most about Wednesday was when John Harris was testifying, saying, "Dad, I told you about this. Why are you saying that you didn't know about it?" Mark Harris is sitting there in tears.
Mm-hmm. And I think for any parent, it makes you think about the relationship you might have with your children, how you got to this point. I mean, this was something that, of course, is so public, a campaign that was on display, but it was also this very personal moment. And I don't know if betrayal is the right word or not, but you've got someone in the Sun who is a lawyer who works for the government, and I think that it, on some level he was trying to make sure that he didn't expose himself here. So it was just an incredible moment.
And I guess after that testimony, I guess Mark Harris basically had no alternative but to say, you know what, maybe a new election is the best solution for this problem.
So that was certainly part of the message we got from him, but we also got a little bit of pushback on Thursday morning in which he said that his son has some arrogance. He also said he loved his son with all of his heart, but he did push back against his son, not that arrogance necessarily has to do with email warnings. And then right before Mark Harris said that he supported a new election, he talked about some health problems, some recent health problems he's had, including an infection that turned septic, which, I mean, can be deadly in a matter of hours, and also noted that he had had two strokes. So with health issues also as part of this narrative, one would think with all of this that has played out, he's not going to run again based on, you know, just the scandal itself. And then you add in health problems, and this just continues to get more and more layered.
Now, this is just not a rematch. It's not a Democrat versus a Republican. A new election will also mean a new primary.
Absolutely correct. There will be a filing season. There will be a primary. If neither of the candidates in either of the primary races reaches 30% of the vote, there would be a runoff primary, and then there will be a general election. Now, that's to say, I guess, two things. This will be an open race, and perhaps we're going to see a number of folks jump into it. There are several people at the North Carolina legislature who potentially would be a good candidate here. And also, just with that timeline that we just touched on briefly, filing period, primary, possible second primary, general election, most of 2019 is going to pass before there is representation in the 9th or, as you mentioned off the top, the 3rd district, congressional district here in North Carolina.
The one with Walter Jones. Back in the, staying in the 9th district for a second, Robert Pittenger was the Republican incumbent whom Harris beat in the May primary, perhaps with these fraudulent votes. Is Pittenger a possible candidate?
Pittenger has signaled that he is not going to get back into the race. However, and I have not had any one-on-one conversations with the former congressman, I think that if the Republican Party wants to make a push in the short term to keep this seat, and it's a seat they've had for more than half a century, I believe, consecutively, I think they're going to apply a little bit of encouragement or pressure, call it what you will, for Pittenger to reconsider. Because I do think that if you think about the optics of this, right, I think there's going to be some sympathy for Dan McCready as somebody who lost by a very narrow margin in a race where certainly some fraud has been exposed. And perhaps for Pittenger as well, because if you go just one step further back, he lost in the primary and there were certainly some irregularities there in addition to what happened in the general election.
You know, there's an irony here. The Republicans always talk about election fraud, and the Democrats always say that such accusations are overblown, and we're seeing the opposite in this case.
In a word, yes. And then in three words, yes, we are. but I mean, you think about insanity, right? I mean, the practice of things just repeating themselves over and over. And, you know, as I think about a special election playing out, and then, of course, you know, the next congressional race in the 9th district in 2020, and that, of course, is presuming that the congressional districts here don't change too much because it's North Carolina and there's gerrymandering, there's plenty of litigation going on.
Basically, we're looking at a very interesting political year of 2019.
Absolutely, Ken.
Jeff Tiberi is a political reporter for radio station WUNC. Jeff, thanks so much for being on the program.
Absolute pleasure, Ken. Take care.
And I'd also like to thank reporter Rusty Jacobs, also of WUNC, who had been at the hearing all week and kept us posted with updates.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All rhymes are true. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dick. He's gonna roll a hook at the top, so need to get the pocket for a hole.
Before we go, there's an election for mayor of Chicago on Tuesday. Rahm Emanuel, after two terms, said back in September that he was calling it quits.
As much as I love this job and will always love this city and its residents, I've decided not to seek re-election.
Most of the headlines about Chicago lately have been about its murder rate and police conduct. And that's what 14 candidates are talking about. They're on the ballot in Tuesday's election. Of course, if no one receives a majority of the vote, a runoff will be held in April. A.D. Quigg is covering the race for The Daily Line, an invaluable Chicago news service focusing on politics and policy, covering City Hall and the City Council. A.D., as some of you might remember, was the first editor of this program. She and I first worked together on Talk of the Nation at NPR. We moved together to The Political Junkie, but she left because I was paying her too much money.
Oh, come on.
AD, it's wonderful to hear your voice again.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, before we get into Tuesday's election, how would you rate the job Mayor Emanuel did? I mean, what would you say were his biggest accomplishments, his failures, and in what shape is he leaving the city for his successor?
Well, he accomplished a lot. Some would say a few things. He got us over a pension hurdle. There's still a lot to go. Mayor Richard M. Daley was basically accused of kicking the can down the road, not making enough payments for city employees. Emanuel raised a lot of taxes and got us on a path to kind of fixing that pension problem. He's made some improvements to education in terms of test results and making high schools here more desirable. He will bring this up at every opportunity. Record corporate relocations. He got a lot of companies to move into downtown. And just outside of the Loop here, our central business district, including big tech companies. Also expanded a lot of parks, beautified downtown, and we're going to get the Obama Presidential Center eventually. But on the flip side, the property tax increase to help pay for those pensions has gotten a lot of backlash. He closed 50 public schools early in his administration, predominantly in black and brown neighborhoods in the city, closed 7 city-run mental health clinics, and those corporate relocations brought in a lot of wealth that has pushed up housing prices in a lot of neighborhoods and displaced other people. And of course, there's the legacy of the Laquan McDonald shooting. He was killed by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. That shooting brought in the Justice Department, and now the police are under a consent decree for reforms. And consent decrees are not short or inexpensive, so there are a lot of things he's done in the meantime to reform the department. But trust in police isn't quite there, nor is a feeling of public safety. So crime and taxes, like in all municipal elections, are a big issue here.
Well, I know, you know, with 14 candidates running, and I want you to go over a listing of some of the people who are running, but I can't help but start with the one guy who has this very familiar name, and his last name is Daley.
Yes, it's kind of unbelievable that Chicago would have another Daley. He's not a fixture around here. I mean, I kind of think of him as a D.C. guy.
Yeah, I was going to say he's a national guy. He's always been a political powerhouse, but right, is this the first time he's ever run for office?
Yes. Well, he flirted with running for governor, but abandoned that pretty quickly. So he was former chief of staff for Barack Obama, Commerce Secretary for Bill Clinton, advisor to his brother, former Mayor Richard M. Daley, son of Mayor Richard J. Daley, brother of Cook County Commissioner John Daley, uncle of Chicago Alderman Patrick Daley Thompson.
Is he related to the Chicago Daily News?
He is not.
Okay.
But the list goes on. I mean, the Daleys have not gone away in Chicago. There's still a ton of them out there. His nephew is also helping manage his campaign. And in a lot of parts of the city, that's still a name that people like and appreciate. And even though Bill Daley is kind of considered a D.C. guy, he's also considered a neighborhood guy because he's still from here and he still has all these deep family connections.
What does he stand for? I mean, what are his strengths? What are his weaknesses?
So his biggest strength right now is he's raised the most money, about $8.5 million so far, a lot from big bank and corporate types because he also worked at J.P. Morgan Chase. He's running on a property tax freeze. He's doing a ton of TV. Also, tough on crime, wants a police camera on every corner. He talks a lot like his brother, Richie. He's playing up his national connections a lot. His commercials have pictures of Obama, pictures of Clinton. His big strength is the money, but also obviously the name ID, where the folks that lived through the Daley era and liked the Daley era want another one back in office. Being a Daley is also a big weakness. Folks are tying him to a lot of the bad parts of Richie's administration. There was a series of hiring scandals and a parking meter deal that is almost universally hated here. We're also going through a giant corruption scandal right now. First, our longest serving alderman and most powerful alderman, Ed Burke, was charged with attempted extortion. And then we found out that the chair of our zoning committee had been wearing a wire for 2 years. There are a lot of unanswered questions, but the aldermen are very paranoid that they've been caught on the wire or felt betrayed that someone that they trusted had been wearing a wire for 2 years. So there's a lot of talk about rats, but also what was captured on the wire and how their connections to both of these politicians appear to the average voter. So if you're friends with either of these aldermen who got wrapped up in this wiretap, does that mean you're dirty too?
Two of the candidates who are running, I remember them running in previous elections. Gary Chico, he ran against Emanuel in 2011. And I also remember that he ran in 2004 for the Senate. The winner of that primary was some guy named Barack Obama. So I want to talk about him. But I also want to talk about Paul Vallis. He once headed up the Chicago public schools. He also ran for governor a bunch of years ago. So I guess voters are pretty familiar with both of those men.
Pretty familiar, but there's tons of young voters here who have never heard of either of them. There are a ton of voters my age, I'm in my late 20s, who graduated from college and moved to Chicago that are voting maybe for the second time in this city after the midterm. So I think that's been a hurdle for both of them to kind of get over. So Gary Chico was chief of staff to Richie Daley. He headed up both the city and state's boards of education, big education message, wants to expand vocational schools here. Also a well-known lobbyist, and he came out of Alderman Ed Burke's finance committee. He's the one who was charged with attempted extortion. So he's one of what are being called here the Burke Four, which is meant to connote some kind of corruptness. Still, regardless, tons of solid fundraising, pretty solid polling. He's among, you know, a top five group of people who have been hovering between 12 and 17% in these polls, which is so crazy to think about. The front runners are only down in 12 and 17%. He came in second to Rahm in 2011 in the mayor's race with about 23% of the vote and six other candidates. Paul Vallis and Gary Chico worked together during the Daley administration. I would say Paul is our most loquacious candidate. His joke is every time he opens his mouth, a white paper falls out. But he's framing himself as the most substantive candidate. His proposals on how to fix pensions, how to stabilize the budget, increase police hiring, all laid out in these lovely long bullet points. He ran and lost in the Democratic primary for governor in 2002 against Rod Blagojevich and Roland Burris. He was behind Rod by about 3 points because he didn't do well downstate. So I'm curious to see how he does with people who have lived here for a while. There are people that like his record on schools. He built schools all around the city.
And I see there, I mean, you're going through the list of names. There are a bunch of women who are running, including Susana Mendoza, who's a state controller.
Yeah, she is well known in Chicago. She's been in politics pretty much since straight out of college. She started working for an alderman here, Ray Frias. So she started working for him, and then a week later, he was indicted in the Silver Shovel investigation, which is kind of similar to what's going on right now, kind of aldermen trading their position for money. But Ray Frias was the only one to get off. She was then a state rep for a long time, then city clerk of Chicago. As comptroller, she got a reputation for being kind of the attack dog for the Democratic Party against Governor Bruce Rauner during our two-year budget crisis. Along the way in her career, she's made alliances with a lot of powerful people, including folks who have now been tangled up in this wiretap mess, and that's been kind of hard to shake for her, but she's painting herself as the kind of young, energetic person that can get the city out of a mess and also kind of playing up, I'm one of the first viable Latino candidates in Chicago in a long time.
Who else should we be paying attention to?
Toni Preckwinkle. She is the president of the Cook County Board of Commissioners and the head of the Cook County Democratic Party, which is kind of the picture we think of when we think of the old Chicago machine.
That's where Richard J. Daley was when he was elected.
Right. So if she won, she would be, you know, the new Richard J. Daley, but she's an African-American woman. And she has also said, you know, I'm not like Richie Daley. I've been a progressive forever. She was an alderman on the south side of Chicago in the 90s. She has big, big, big union support here from the Chicago Teachers Union and service employees. They are two of the most powerful in the city and the state. She also is pulling in some national endorsements, Valerie Jarrett and Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. But she's also kind of been caught up in this corruption scandal a bit. Ed Burke was trying to shake down someone to give her $10,000 when she ran for Cook County Board President. She's returned all the money connected to Burke, but like Mendoza, she's kind of struggled to get away from that image and run the campaign she wanted, which was, I'm a black woman. I could be the first black woman to lead this city.
And Lori Lightfoot is running too. She's a former police board president, correct?
Yes. Also a former federal prosecutor. She's been front and center on a lot of police reform issues since the Laquan McDonald shooting. She wrote and headed up a big task force to identify all the reforms that the department needed. She also prosecuted aldermen as part of that Silver Shovel investigation I was talking about earlier. If she won, she would be the city's first African-American and first openly gay mayor, which is interesting, but not something she plays up very much.
Not the first African-American mayor.
Female.
African-American female. Female, yeah, right.
Yes.
With 14 candidates, I mean, it's almost impossible to get a sense of what's happening. But you want to just give us a guesstimate of who has the best chance of making the runoff?
I'm kind of loath to make a guess. The margins are so close on all the polling I've seen. And municipal election polling is so tricky in the first place because the sample size is very small, and we're not sure how many young voters that came out so strong in the midterms will show up again. Some political watchers are saying it's going to be Preckwinkle and Daley just because of all the money Daley has and the institutional support Preckwinkle has from unions. But there are all these crazy new headlines every day about corruption, wild revelations, and things here can and usually do change on a dime. I was on a panel a couple days ago with a bunch of really high information voters in the room. And we kind of asked everyone to raise their hand to say, have you decided who you're going to vote for yet? 80% of the room didn't know. This was like a week before the election. So plus there's a ton of mail-in ballots. That's a big deal here now, which means we might not know the results on Tuesday night because they'll still be counting all those mail-in and provisional ballots. And I don't know. It's just so up in the air. I can't wait to see.
I can't remember a Chicago mayor's race that is so completely wide open like this.
No, I don't think we've had a contested one like this in more than 100 years. Plus, we've got a whole city council to elect. It's going to be wild. This is why Chicago politics is the best.
A.D. Quigg is a reporter for The Daily Line, the comprehensive political news service in Chicago. You can find out more at thedailyline.net. A.D., it's great having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken. I miss you.
I miss you, too.
I fell in love again. All things go, drove to Chicago. All things know, we sold our clothes to the state. I don't mind, I don't mind. I made a lot of mistakes in my mind.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram, at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. You can't.